Heavenly Father, we are your servants here in this process of building these classical Christian schools. You lead us one step at a time, and you give us the grace when we need it. Bless us this morning and teach us about art, for you are the great artist. Help us to appreciate you as that artist. Help us to reflect that wonderful gift and your beauty. And may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in thy sight. May you be glorified. In Jesus' name. I want to clear up any confusion that may have arisen. I had a friend say, "Carol, what's with that bio? Are you a doctor or something?" And I thought, "Oh no, what is with that bio?" So I checked it out again, and I saw that it said that I had a degree from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Well, that's true, but I'm not a doctor. It was degree is a master's in medical illustration. So that's a far cry from being a doctor. So I can't write you a prescription, but I could draw you a kidney very well. So very different. I'd also like to begin by telling a story. This is sort of by way of introduction, and as an artist, I sort of think in pictures. So this story is referred to affectionately by my children as the bird story. And I'm really exposing myself here. So when I was a child, about 8 years old, one of my favorite things to do was stare out the window at the birds that would fly around. I love birds. I know I share that love with some of you. My favorite bird was the blue jay. I think because blue just doesn't exist in nature that often, and they were just so dynamic and would stand out against the background, and I would sit for hours watching these blue jays. Well, one morning, as I was walking in my backyard, I happened to spy on the ground this beautiful dead blue jay. And I ran over and scooped it up and took it up to my bedroom, opened the drawer of my nightstand, put it in the drawer, and promptly forgot about it. And I think that kids, I don't think their olfactory senses work very well, because I didn't really notice anything, but my poor mother did. And of course, she came in and opened the drawer, and that was the end of my blue jay. But there was something about wanting to capture this creation, this thing that God had made. It was so beautiful, and I wanted it. And while it was in my drawer, it was mine, you know. But there was just this impulse to capture nature. I think that is an impulse that artists have. So keep that little story in the back of your mind. We'll revisit it a little later. Well, I'm the art teacher at Marshall Academy, and it has been such a blessing to host you all here this weekend. I've been there for 4 years. I had absolutely no intention of teaching outside the home. I homeschooled for several years, and then my oldest began the third grade at Mars Hill Academy. At the same time, the art teacher moved away, and she had done a lovely job with the art program, but everybody was thinking, oh no, what are we going to do? Well, I thought I could probably help out a little, and they took our names for, you know, volunteering once a month, and I thought, I could do that. I could be part of this rotation. And then the secretary informed me that I was the only one who had signed up. And so the rest is history. And here I am now teaching the grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric at Mars Hill, K through 12, although next year I'll only be teaching grammar. And really today is just so much a testimony of what God has done. I'm just in awe of how he brought me from, you know, from the beginnings to this point, and all the things that he's taught me. And I hope that that's what I can do today, is share that with you and encourage you in your journey in art education. The reason, and that's the reason why I entitled this The Essentials of Art, because I was standing at a place 4 years ago when I had to say, okay, what do I teach these kids? What are the basics? What is the grammar of art? And have worked through it systematically since then. I'd like to begin with a review of the stages of the trivium, the grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. Now, the grammar is when the students learn the language of their subjects. They learn well by memorization, rote memorization, by chants and songs. No sound. Okay. Okay. The dialectic stage is the one in which the students are thinking through what they've been taught. They're questioning, they're making connections. And my PowerPoint isn't working. There we go. Okay. And then the rhetoric stage is the one in which the students are expressing these thoughts, these connections with eloquence and style. Now, a rhetoric arts student, I think, should also have a wide experience of different media and particularly a mastery of drawing. They should also have a knowledge of art history, and they should be able to express themselves in art with eloquence and style. We hope that when these rhetoric students graduate, they'll be able to engage the world in meaningful discussion about our Creator and everything within His realm, hopefully positively affecting our culture. So we need to keep in mind the stages, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. I believe a triune approach is the best way to achieve the goal of an accomplished rhetoric arts student, but we must start in the grammar stage. Now, this triune approach consists of three components: the discipline of drawing, the discipline of art history, and the discipline of aesthetics. Again, the training begins in the grammar school. It's the foundation, the ground floor, so to speak. Well, what is the foundation of art? Drawing, really, is the most basic artistic activity one can do. It's the alphabet with which the language of art is spoken. But it's becoming a lost art. Now, in the 20th century, we saw a departure from this discipline, much to the detriment of art, at least the discipline of drawing realistically. And, in fact, the art world today is beginning to bemoan the fact that people don't know how to draw. I read an article recently by an art critic who said, "Where are all the draftsmen? Why can't anybody draw?" Well, it's not being taught. I also took an oil painting class last fall, and I was surprised to overhear my teacher say that she had to spend so much time going over drawing with the students that they couldn't go on to painting. So it really is foundational. The other problem, then, is in the art education, because kids aren't getting the basics of drawing. Pablo Picasso said, "Every child is an artist." So that seems to be what you would define the current art educational philosophy by. Every child is an artist. Anytime a child puts pencil to paper, that's art. Anytime he puts a brush in his hand, that's art. I know of a dolphin in Florida who paints. They put a brush in his mouth and the paintings by Sunset the Dolphin. Okay, that's enough to be art. I don't agree. I do agree that every child can learn to draw, or almost every child, just as almost every child can learn to play an instrument, but that doesn't mean they're going to grow up to be artists or musicians. I have two examples. One is the artist John James Audubon, and if you're familiar with him at all, he was drawing and painting in the 1800s, and he's sort of known as the bird artist. He's the one who did all these lovely, detailed, accurate drawings of, I think, every species of bird in North America. Well, if you looked at his drawings when he was a child, you never would have thought he would attain this goal, but he worked and worked and worked and finally got to a point where he could be considered a master of his art. I have this little second grader whom I adore. His name is Thomas, and he's wonderful. And he has problems with his motor skills, his fine motor skills. And so you would think we could excuse him, but no, he loves art, and he loves to draw, and he'll be drawing away and say, "Thomas, how are you doing?" "Great. So thrilled." And this year, I was probably the highlight of my year. I saw him drawing part of a still life, and I actually, you know, his drawing actually was looking like what he was trying to draw, and it was such a victory and such a breakthrough, and I thought, wow, if Thomas, who you know, really does have a disability, can draw and can learn to draw, you know, and attain a certain level of mastery, then really just about anybody can. Okay. Giorgio Vasari was a 16th century painter and the father of art history. He referred to drawing as the mother of painting, and considered it the basis of all artistic activity, including sculpture and architecture. You can think of painting as drawing with a brush, or sculpting as drawing with clay. Florence, Italy, was the center of intense artistic activity during the period we know as the Renaissance. And the city was known for its exquisite drawings. The city nurtured artists like Michelangelo, Da Vinci, and Raphael, whom we admire to this day because of their great skill. They are looked at as examples, as masters. They achieved a great degree of realism, accuracy, and an ability to capture nature in their artwork. Children need to learn to draw realistically. They need to learn this skill. Well, does that mean that abstract art or non-representational art isn't valid? No, not at all. Consider Pablo Picasso. He was an expert draftsman, a child prodigy. But in his later years, we all know, he chose not to draw realistically. It wasn't that he couldn't draw realistically. There was a reason why he put noses on the side of his faces and so forth. Okay, so it seems to me that there's more validity in the artwork of one who's mastered his discipline, but chooses to depart from its strictest boundaries, rather than one who's not mastered his discipline, or cannot master the discipline. One can draw realistically or not. The other can only draw unrealistically because that's all he can do. He's limited. So he is not a master, but a slave. And in this sense, discipline is freedom. Well, some might say, isn't drawing a talent? Something that God gives you, either have it or you don't. Well, it is a talent, but it's also a skill that can be learned. And the best tool that I found to teach this skill of drawing is the book by Mona Brooks called Drawing with Children. She provides a language for the student and teacher to speak so they can communicate. And I remember standing in that first class, I think there were seventh graders, and thinking, okay, I know I can draw. Now, how in the world am I going to tell them how to draw? I didn't know how to get the information from my head to them. Well, she's provided a bridge because she's provided a language for the teacher and student to use. And she's broken down the drawing process into simple marks she calls elements of shapes. And she puts them in families. Now, she has a very broad definition of these families. For instance, the dot family isn't, you know, just your typical dot, but it's any circular shape colored in. The circle family is a circular shape not colored in, and so on. And this gives the students a really broad arsenal from which to choose so that they can make their drawings. She provides worksheets so that the students can practice the marks. Oh, I'm sorry, but the sound doesn't work, right? Okay. She provides worksheets with which to practice the marks. So we go a step at a time, incrementally. Okay, and then she uses the marks to make simple shapes and then more complicated shapes. Then this technique can be applied to anything the students might want to draw. So those are the simple shapes and the more complicated shapes. Now, we do these together as a class. We work through these drawings as a class, and I stand at the board, and I can go through the thinking process and the drawing process with the students, and, you know, I'll say, we're going to draw a bird. Yay, we're going to draw a bird. That's great. So they have no idea how this is going to happen when they start the class, and by the end of the class, there's this beautiful bird. We go just a step at a time, and that way I can stop anywhere along the line, and I can check their progress, and it takes time. But that's the way they learn it, and that's the way they learn how to use these elements. This process of putting together shapes is synthesis. Analyzing also takes place. It's looking at a shape already put together and trying to figure out what it's made up of. Used together, the analysis and synthesis is part of the drawing process. I find that the younger students are much better at putting together shapes, and that the analysis comes with time and practice. I also find that so much of what I'm teaching these children is how to see. Children tend to draw what they think something looks like, not what it really looks like. For example, if we were to describe a coffee cup and say that the mouth of the cup is a circle, okay, we all know that's true. If I put it on the table in front of a student and they try to draw it, they draw a circle. Well, the problem with that is
when it's sitting on the table and at the angle at which they're looking at it, it doesn't look like a circle anymore. It looks like an ellipse, but they'll still draw the circle. So I need to stop them and get them to really look at the object they're trying to draw. Come around and say, is that what that really looks like? Look again. Look harder. And because it doesn't even occur to them that it's not a circle. So they need to be taught to see differently and to observe carefully. Now, along with this observation comes memory. What is it that enables us to look at an object, turn our eyes away from it, and transfer what we saw to paper? Well, it's memory. God has given us this inner eye, this camera that we can use. We're taking pictures all day long. This transfer process, consisting of observation and memory, is also part of the drawing process. They are key tools enabling a student to analyze an object so that he can synthesize it on paper. So you've got observation, analysis, memory, and synthesis, and it would work something like this. I look at the coffee cup and observe it. Try to figure out what marks were used to make up the coffee cup. I take it apart so that I can put it back together. Then I turn away, look at my paper, use that picture that I've taken in my mind, that memory, and then put it back together on paper, synthesize it on paper. It seems that our culture, however, has lost the inclination for contemplation and patient observation, but it's such a necessary tool that crosses the boundaries of many disciplines. You think about, and the science teacher and I worked closely together, and it was so much fun, but you think about we were constantly comparing how similar science and art really are. A scientist has to look through a microscope and use, skilled observational methods to try to distinguish oneself from another. Or perhaps a writer who is trying to communicate something to a reader, trying to make some event come alive or describe someone's physical appearance. Well, they need to know how to observe the world around them and then make a catalog, a mental catalog of those observations. I do want to give you an example of Edgar Degas, who was an impressionist painter in the 19th century. Now, Degas loved to draw ballet dancers, and he would spend hours watching the rehearsals, and then he would go home and draw them. He had such acute observational skills and memory. But this is something that needs to be taught and can be taught. And to do this in class, we use memory drills. I put an object in front of the students on the table and have them look at it for several moments, and then I take it away. They really enjoy it. I think also that tracing and copying from photographs is a valid way to learn to draw, but I think for the most part, students need to learn to draw from life. So we do a lot of still life drawings. And I've been known to disrupt the whole school by bringing in live birds of prey for the students to draw. I brought in zoo animals, including an alligator. We go outside and draw. I regularly raid the science teacher's cabinets for articles like starfish and birds' nests and things. The fourth graders have to do a science project in which they collect insects, and that's wonderful fodder for our drawing experience. And another little story. I happened to be at Starbucks, just happened to be there. And if you don't know much about the Marshall teachers, you must know that we have this thing about Starbucks. And we have a small enough school that we will hold class there occasionally. So I was there one morning, and what should I spy lying in the parking lot? This beautiful, dead thrush this time, not a blue jay. So I went to my car and I grabbed a plastic sandwich baggie and scooped it up and brought it to the art room for the students to draw. And I thought, well, things are just coming full circle here. Some of them weren't too crazy about it, but at least I put it in a plastic baggie this time and knew enough to throw it out later. Another tool that I use in conjunction with drawing with children, and I think is very important, is the sketchbook. Now, the sketchbook is part of the supply list every year, and every student has to have one. Most of the work we do in class is done in the sketchbook. It saves money for your art program, for one, but these books become prized possessions. They work out their thoughts, and if there's any leftover time in class, they can draw in their sketchbook. And most of them are begging me for more free drawing time. Well, if drawing is the foundation of all art, then art in the grammar school must contain the discipline of drawing. Remember that a grammar student is a future rhetoric student. The second part of this triune approach is the discipline of art history. Art history is really a companion of world history. It's a visual record of the times and a reflection of our culture. From these visual records, we learn about man's ideas about God, about himself, his political leanings, philosophy, science, literature. For example, the Greek artists were influenced by men like Plato and Protagoras, who said, man is the measure of all things. They achieved a high degree of realism in their artwork, particularly sculpture, in order to convey this humanistic ideal of man being the measure. Now, this thread of humanism runs throughout art history. It appears again in the Renaissance and also in the neoclassical period of the 1700s and 1800s. Because the thinkers of the Renaissance and neoclassical period were looking back to Greece and Rome for inspiration. So there is a connection between what people believe and the art they produce. Now, another example would be the Impressionist painters, whom I love. But they were painting in the latter half of the 19th century after the invention of the camera, and the camera had become more commonplace, and also at a time when scientific discoveries were being made in the areas of optics, color, and light. And so they were using the things that the scientists had learned in their drawings. They were applying paint in a way to mix colors by the eye rather than on the canvas, trying to apply some of these scientific principles. And if you look at some of their paintings, you also see that they're cropped. Sometimes in a funny way, you see half of a person or they're cut off at the leg, which is like a photograph. So you see the influence of the world around them in their paintings. Well, I don't expect grammar students to be making these connections in the grammar stage, but the facts must be given them so that then when they become dialectic and rhetoric students, they'll have these facts at their disposal so they can make these connections and then later express their thoughts. So a student really does need to know the art history timeline. They need to know the foundations upon which our current art culture is based, because we don't live in a vacuum and art doesn't exist in a vacuum. The condition of the arts today is a result of art movements of yesterday, whether it's a rejection of the prior movement or an acceptance of it or continuation of it. So the timeline of art history might include the art of Egypt, Greece, and Rome, the early Christian era, the Middle Ages, Renaissance, Rococo, Baroque, Rococo, Neoclassical, Romantic, Realism, Impressionism, Post-Impressionism, and so on. Those are probably the basic movements, and they can be found in any art history book. Well, how might the timeline be taught in the grammar school? Well, perfect opportunity for a chant, an art history timeline chant or song, which it's my goal to make this year. You could list each movement and the dates of that movement and its distinguishing features. It's just basic facts. Then they'll have them at the ready. What about art history flashcards? We have math flashcards. Why not have paintings on flashcards? You flash it up and they have to tell you the name of the painting or the era or something. Storytelling is another wonderful way to teach students about art and artists. Now, a lot of artists are very unique, and you have to censor a lot, but they lived very interesting lives, and this, you know, that students just grab onto that. They think that's wonderful, and it does. When the story is more interesting, it helps them remember the painting or the era. I also do memory exercises with my students where I hold up a print and have, you know, just for a moment, and then remove it and have them tell me what they saw, describe it. It's like a large version of flashcards. I think that ideally art history should be taught alongside world history, and that's been my attempt in the grammar school. I also use, however, the Adventures of Art series by David Quine because it does give a good overview of the entire canon of art history, kind of the big picture for them to keep in mind. Now, as an example of how I would use teach art history alongside world history, I'll take the fifth grade class. The fifth graders, during their history period, are studying the Renaissance. And so we study art history of the Renaissance. And not only do we study the facts, but we also do some projects so that, you know, we have some integration going between the art they're doing and the art they're learning about. Remember that Renaissance art was very realistic. The illusion of space and form were achieved through the use of perspective and light and dark shading called chiaroscuro. So some of the projects that we do are perspective projects where they learn 1- and 2-point perspective. And then they also learn shading techniques like blending, stippling, and cross-hatching. This way it's connected in their minds. They may not realize it. They'll realize it later. I begin art history in the second grade with Egypt, and that's very informal and low-key, and then work my way up through the sixth grade with 19th century American painting. I like to say the modern era from the mid-1800s on for the dialectic students, because I think that's just perfect time for them to really be looking at some of this work and questioning, and I think some of it needs to be questioned. Well, two references that I use and that I recommend. The first is the Annotated Mona Lisa by Carol Strickland. I think it's an excellent resource, and it's not too much with all the other studying and preparation you have to do. The other is The History of Art for Young People by Janssen. Now, that's a little more tedious and comprehensive, but they're two excellent resources. I don't have a textbook per se for the students, but what I do is when I lecture about a particular painting or time period, I have a handout for them, and that includes all the information I want them to know and what they'll be tested on. So there's no confusion, no questions about that. It would include the title of the painting, the date it was painted, name of the artist, when he lived, and the name of the art period, and some distinguishing features, some facts about that period. For example, we looked at the Mona Lisa. The painting was painted around 1502 to 1505 by Leonardo da Vinci, who lived from 1452 to 1519. It was a Renaissance painting, and some distinguishing features about the Renaissance, and I got these right out of the Annotated Mona Lisa, are the use of perspective, systematic perspective, the perfection of the oil painting technique, the use of pyramidal configuration in composition, and the light and dark shading to make form look three-dimensional. They can memorize those things. It's not that much. I think exposure is key. I think if you can surround the students with beautiful works of art, that's very helpful. I want to tell you about another resource that I discovered. It's the National Gallery of Art Lending Library in Washington, D.C. They will, now I'm always scrambling for visuals, for prints, because art is a visual discipline. You've got to show them artwork or they're not going to be able to understand it. And we have a limited budget. I can't go out and buy a dozen prints, but this lending library has really been wonderful, and it's free. Now, they will mail you slides, videos, or movies of their collection, and all you have to do is pay for the postage. I use this for students studying Greek sculpture, and then also for a survey of American painting. And I also want to mention that I have a resource list that lists all the books that I'm mentioning, as well as the address for the National Gallery and so forth, and it's down here on the podium. You can pick it up later. I also encourage you to make use of your local art museum. I'm very thankful to have the Cincinnati Art Museum because they have a wonderful selection of work scanning the whole of art history, the whole span. They also have started this great addition to their docent guided tours, and it's a hands-on aspect where, you know, if they happen to have an extra one of those little oil lamps from Rome or something, they'll let the kids touch it and pass it around. Boy, you know, that span of history just closes for them when they can actually touch something that was here during the Roman period. Of course, my son's appreciated putting on the gauntlet from the Middle Ages a little bit more. That's okay. They also have a lending library, which I've used. And we were studying cathedrals with the fourth graders. Now, I can't take them to France, which is what I really like to do, to, you know, see a real cathedral and walk through one. But this video was a tremendous help, and I think I will use videos more. Try some local galleries, although I would check out the show first, and also catalogs. I've got the name of several that will sell prints and slides and posters. And again, if you visit a museum, and whenever I go back to Washington, D.C., I visit the National Gallery and come back with armloads of prints that are not very expensive so that I can have them at the ready. Well, remember that all this is done in order to produce a rhetoric art student who has a certain mastery of technique, especially drawing, and who is conversant with major art themes and movements. This last part of the triune approach is aesthetics. It's a big, scary word. It's the branch of philosophy that provides a theory of the beautiful and the fine arts. Well, where does a Christian look for his theory of the beautiful? Well, of course, to God, to the scriptures. He is the creator, the origin of beauty and art. This truth must be stated for these grammar students and emphasized repeatedly. We are made in his image and share an ability to create. It's also a privilege. And it's a responsibility. We want what we make to glorify God. We want the students to see all things, including art, from a Christian worldview perspective. Doug Wilson defines a Christian worldview as a framework of assumptions about reality, all of which are in submission to Christ. We want them to look with a critical eye at artwork, assess, appraise, and decide wisely what to plunder from the Egyptians and what to leave behind. We can equip them for this in the grammar school, by emphasizing God's headship over all creation in every discipline we teach, whether it's art, math, science, literature. And I want to recommend Francis Schaeffer's book and video series, How Shall We Then Live? Because he makes these connections for the reader between the art, philosophy, science, and politics of the time, all within their historical context. He also has this wonderful pamphlet called Art in the Bible that helps with the theory of beauty. So we are equipping the grammar students with the language of art. We've mentioned the language of drawing in art history, and now we need to talk about the language artists use to create complete works of art and to critique art. I'm referring to the elements of art and the elements or principles of design as listed on your handout. And I also think I left one out. The grammar students should be able to list these elements of art and use them in their artwork. The terms are part of the language of art, just like dot, circle, line, curve, line, and angle are part of the language of drawing. The dialectic and rhetoric students practice formal critiques in which they look for the elements and critique art in terms of the artist's use of the elements. But they have to learn to speak the language and use the elements in their own work first. Recognize the wassail tune, and there are, of course, full body movements that go along with the song, which I won't do for you. We do projects focusing on each element, sort of isolating each element, and they are so easy to interweave in the drawing curriculum. We also do simple critiques with the grammar students. A student can explain his work using the language, attempting to use the language of art, the elements, and then the other students can offer constructive criticism. Now, this is a really good place for those students to learn how to critique without being demeaning or critical, and also for students to learn how to accept criticism in the positive way in which it's meant. The elements of design, balance, pattern, movement, unity, emphasis, contrast, and rhythm, are more abstract concepts, and I have the grammar students memorize them, but they don't really practice them until dialectic. In conclusion, a rhetoric student who is convinced of God's sovereignty, skilled in art techniques, conversant with art history, adept at critiquing and appraising artwork, and able to express himself and the truth artistically with eloquence and style is the goal of not only the rhetoric teacher, but the grammar teacher as well. Schaeffer's quote, "A Christian is the one whose imagination should fly beyond the stars," is descriptive of the kind of artwork a rhetoric student can do. Remember that the grammar stage is where the foundation is laid. The battery of knowledge we hope our rhetoric students have at the ready must be broken down into bite-sized pieces that are chewable for the grammar student. And I try to remember Doug Wilson's encouragement that we're teaching what we love to students we love. And that's what I see as my job, loving these kids and encouraging them to love art and especially love the creator of art using classical methods. Now, not all of my students, as much as I would like, will grow up to be artists, but their souls and the souls of those around them will be enriched by their love of and appreciation for art. I think we have 5 minutes. If you have any questions, otherwise I can hang around. Thank you so much. Yes. Yes. I knew this question would come up. They can't handle a lot of it, yeah. I knew I'd get a question about nudes. I just didn't think it would be the first question. That's okay. Her question was, especially in studying the Renaissance, there are a lot of nudes in the Renaissance, and I realize that that can be a real problem. I think some of it, I truly think it's okay to show some of that if the students can handle it. You know, if they're going to be silly and not be able to handle it or to look at it maturely, then you should probably try to find work that that doesn't show the full body. And like with Michelangelo's David, I cut his bottom half off. So I've used post-it notes before, you know, we could be creative, but I've looked at the internet for other sources and things like that. There are beautiful pieces of work that don't include nudity, but you're right, a lot of it does, and that's sort of the beginning of when so much of it entered into the canon of art. So, sure. Right. Well, the question was, could you just use a detail of a painting? Absolutely. Yeah, and try to find one that will convey the principles you're trying to teach. Yeah, sometimes the sketches that the artist does before the paintings can be helpful. And we don't have to include all of the nudity that there is. And I try to be really careful when I show, because some of it truly is lustful. And some of it is lustful in the way it's conveyed, but some of it isn't. And so it's honestly a dilemma I haven't worked through yet, because I drew nudes in college. That's what we did, and I didn't question it. And that was part of art school. That's what we did. So now, 20 years later, I'm thinking, But the problem is that we're trying to convey truth. If we don't know what the body looks like, it won't be true in our drawings and paintings. And I've studied cadavers, and they are not true to life. So that's not really an option either. I don't know the solution, but that's something that we'll have to, you know, maybe you'll come up with the answer. Yes. Right. The question was, are there other venues outside the school in which to show the artist's work, the student's work, or perhaps contests for them to be involved in? Yes, but we're a fairly small school, and quite honestly, we're limited in a lot we can do. For instance, I don't do a lot of painting because we're renting a church building, and I am real nervous about ruining that building, and so I've just accepted the fact that I'm going to be limited in what I can do. And since I am only one person and I have three children and a wonderful husband, I have to be really careful about all this other stuff I do. But absolutely, whatever you are able to do, I would do. I would certainly try to create other venues. I know there's a large Christian school down the road from me, and they have a fine arts day that is huge. It's advertised in the papers, and they get a lot of press about it. They get a lot of visitors, and they do all their musical and drama and visual arts. So I think that would be a great thing for the students to work toward all year. We just don't do it because we're so limited, but that would be something I'd love to do someday. So excellent idea. Any other questions? Yes. Do I sell the art song? No. I'm not a musician. I haven't even thought about that. Sorry? She can use it, of course. Yes, absolutely. Use it with my blessings. I'll even show you the little motions that go along with it. Any other questions? But the singing, doesn't that help them? They just... That's why that, you know, why is the alphabet in that order? Is it because of that song? No. You know, that's how we, who's going to forget the alphabet? Nobody. It's drilled in there for training. I know the parents know the art song. They know. Neighbors. Everybody knows it. I have most classes twice a week, and really, honestly, it comes down to about 45 minutes. That, too, limits what we can do. Right, and don't have a lot of help as far as cleanup and so forth. So, you know, I've come to accept what we can and can't do, I hope. But I'm always, you know, I've got that vision that this is what I want to do. This is what I have to do now. So keep the vision in mind. Anything else? Yes. Yeah. Well, I used to get, the question was first graders using a coloring book as opposed to a sketchbook? Oh, yes. I recommend the sketchbook highly. I use it with my first grade, with my kindergarten. And this is my own sketchbook. This is a big deal for them. Absolutely use the sketchbook. And I do teach the students to draw in the line while we're mentioning coloring books. You know, they've got to learn to draw inside the line before they can have permission to draw outside the line. I know that's not a popular view today. Draw outside the lines, but I think they need to learn to draw inside the line. We teach neat coloring skills. So, anything else? Yes. 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 Good question. The question was, with the Mona Brooks book, do I use the markers? Because she almost exclusively uses markers. I do at the beginning, and it's great because you probably have these students draw a line, erase a line. Draw two lines, erase. You know, they get so dependent on that eraser. I don't let them use an eraser in the first few years. I think the marker helps them loosen up and, oh, it's a mistake. Oh, well. You know, we practice turning those mistakes into other things, trying to be creative with them, just to try to loosen them up and not be so uptight about it. Part of it, I think, is that they do need to relax. But I do have to say, I don't use the latter half of the book much because when you're teaching shading and things, I'd much rather use pencils and charcoal. So for this, that beginning stage, I think it's ideal. Any other questions? Thank you so much.